Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is America's best idea? It's a question open for vigorous debate in a nation that has given the world the microchip, the light bulb, and assembly line production, not to mention baseball and jazz. But documentarian Ken Burns, on upcoming PBS series, will make a strong case for the national park. There are 58 of them in the U.S., along with 333 national monuments, that without the national park system as we know it today might have left the care and control of some of the world's greatest vistas to less than honorable private citizens tempted to put profit ahead of preservation. Burns explores the genesis of the park system in a 12-hour, six-part film called The National Parks, America's Best Idea. The series will debut in the fall on PBS stations, including KERA 13. Ken Burns is in town to appear tonight at the Meyerson Symphony Center as a guest of the Brinker International Forum. We are delighted to have him with us in studio this afternoon. Ken, welcome to Think.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
How familiar were you with the whole park system before you started the project?
Not very. You know, the Civil War series had brought us to some of the national battlefield parks, but my introduction to the national parks came with this project, and that's the way it should be. You know, we don't want to tell you what you should know in these films. That's homework. We'd rather share with you our process of discovery. And my goodness, what a process of discovery this series was. We've been working on it for 10 years.
Yeah, as I watched and I saw just a part of the series last night, it's amazing to me that the people involved are every bit as interesting to find out about as just, I expected beautiful vistas good writing, as always, but these people are remarkable.
Well, you know, it's so funny. We had everybody likes the high concept title, and we ran into to a woman who couldn't really figure this out, and we were showing some clips. She goes, "Oh, I get it. It's the planet Earth with people." And so, yes, there's gorgeous cinematography, but that's just the backdrop. This is the story of the individuals and the ideas that made this uniquely American thing happen. And so when you lift up the rock of any national park, it's not some benevolent senator or president or famous person. They're often involved, and not to take away from their efforts. But more often than not, it's a regular person of every possible background, male and female, rich and poor, young and old, from every corner of the country and from beyond our shores, who have helped wake us up to a particular spot and have saved it against that utterly human and really utterly American impulse to, you know, put a dam on that nice river, to look at a stand of trees and think, bored feet, or to see a canyon and think, mine. And if we'd allowed that to happen, there'd be no place in the United States where we can stand and see what it was like 150 years ago when John Muir saw it, or 15,000 years ago when the ancient ancestors of the native peoples who were first here on this place looked at the waterfall at Yosemite, or the incredible geothermal features at Yellowstone, or the grandest canyon on Earth, all of which we are. You and I and everyone within the sound of our voices, co-owners of. And, you know, you can debate the best idea. Maybe it's Thomas Jefferson's. But once we started this whole thing, I'd be hard-pressed to find a better idea than the national parks, the idea of setting aside this for everybody and for all time.
How did the park system start to grow?
Well, a lot of people think the parks have always been there. They haven't. A lot of them think that the National Park Service has always been there. It hasn't. The National Park Service, just to give you an idea, does not show up in our series until halfway through the third of our six episodes. So who's taking care of them? How did they come into play? All of that is one of the most fascinating stories. In the beginning, in the middle of the Civil War, we set aside Yosemite, gave it to the state of California to take care of. But this was something Abraham Lincoln signed in the middle of trying to deal with the greatest crisis in the history of the United States. 8 years later, Grant signed into law Yellowstone. Well, Yellowstone was in a place called Wyoming Territory. There was no government. And so kind of by default, nobody really looked. It became the world's first national park. And it wasn't like July 4th, 1776, where everybody would set off the fireworks and the bells and say, isn't this a great moment? They sort of walked away from that, but had created something and set in motion stuff that then had to be protected. Who would take care of it? Well, the cavalry did at the beginning, and some of those cavalry were African Americans. And in the first decade of the 20th century, when African Americans were being lynched at a greater rate than at any other time in our history, they were telling people what to do at Sequoia and Yosemite National Parks, Yosemite having been given back by the state of California to the government of the United States. So every single park has a story as complicated and as interesting as that one. And even within those stories are sub-stories that we tell. So we've spent 10 years trying to intertwine and interbraid all of this stuff together into a coherent narrative, which just happens to be set against the backdrop of the most spectacular scenery on Earth.
I think a lot of people know Theodore Roosevelt for caring very deeply about the country and the environment. But I love the moment when he arrives himself for the first time at Grand Canyon and has this sort of transcendent experience, as we all do, but he had the power to do something about it.
He's one of the more formidable characters in all of American history. The fact that he has turned the country's attention towards conservation is to our great benefit, and still that benefit redounds through the ages. Yeah, he had always been fascinated with the West, was on a big, huge lecture tour, traveling through lots and lots of states as presidents, and had been to Yellowstone and went off by himself for a couple of weeks in Yellowstone with just like one guide, and that was it. The president of the United States sleeping outdoors. It doesn't happen today. And he made this little whistle stop at the Grand Canyon, and he'd never seen it before, and he just came out with this magnificent statement about what human, you know, the ages, you know, leave it as it is. The ages have been at work in it, and man can only mar it. And what he was sort of saying is that, and if there was anyone more into progress than Theodore Roosevelt, I'd like to know it. But he understood that our acquisitive and extractive energies also have to be arrested sometimes, that we have to have these little oases and refuges, not just for the game and for the beautiful scenery, but for our souls. So he understood the implicit democratic ideal of the national parks and what they represented. And of course, it's always in tension with local interests. So when he tried for years to try to get the Grand Canyon, which seemed obvious as a national park, and the local opposition in Arizona was unbelievable. We don't want the federal government telling us what to do. All the things we hear today and the tension between local and federal stuff. And he finally evoked the Antiquities Act that allowed him to set aside what was originally thought would only be a few thousand acres when the Antiquities Act was evoked, that a president would have this power. But he did 860,000 acres, and all hue and cry broke out in Arizona. Well, you know, it dies down. It's on their license plate. They're the Grand Canyon State. And I can't imagine there's anybody in Arizona that doesn't think this is one of the greater things to have protected ever.
Well, you talk about local opposition. And in fact, one of the sort of villains of the film is this guy who felt like he ought to own it and was charging people. And he certainly comes across as a nefarious guy. But in some ways, it's funny that sort of entrepreneurial spirit comes across. And this guy is charging people for everything from water when they're dying of thirst at the bottom to the only restrooms.
This is Ralph Henry Cameron, who just assumed that, you know, as so many Americans did who were homesteading out in the arid and vacant West, that, you know, you apply for a claim and it's yours. But he also understood this was the grandest canyon on Earth, and people were coming from around the world. There was money to be made not so much from the mining claims spurious mining claims, but from this idea of exploiting it. And a lot of people were saying, it's ours in the biggest sense of the word. I mean, it could be, you know, Arizona State Park, and that vista would still be there. But that sense of pride, of national ownership that you have, it does so much for the spirit. We talk about today how fractured we are, and everything's dialectically preoccupied. We're red state or we're blue state. We're male, we're female, we're black, we're white, we're west, we're east. No, we're north, we're south. Everything's divided. We forget to select for that thing we share in common. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the late historian, said we suffer from too much pluribus and not enough unum. And he's right. And I think one of the things that suggests that unum are the national parks, and particularly in tough times as we're in now. The national parks enjoyed the first stimulus money of FDR's New Deal during the Depression, and people were not just given jobs here in Texas at Big Bend, which was aborning. They were given the dignity of what a job meant, and more than that, people flocked to their national parks, sometimes to camp out, to live, others to just sort of feel that cohesion. And what I'm hoping is that we can reinvigorate our interest in these things. Yesterday, I was in the White House, and the president set aside 2 million acres as part of an enlarged park system that would protect rivers and their wild and scenic things, to add wilderness areas in 9 different states. It was really a wonderful, wonderful moment. And you realize there's more than enough land to exploit. There's more than enough land to drill and explore and things like that. But we do have to have these oases where we can go and have, as you're talking about, these kind of experiences that Teddy Roosevelt had, where we just experience something outside of ourselves. And that's, I think, one of the great gifts of the park. And it's hard to talk about things in spiritual terms that way because people misunderstand. But I think their greatest value is in that spiritual effect.
Well, one thing I think is really amazing about national parks is that a lot of Americans who feel entirely disconnected from nature in their day-to-day lives, they live in cities or they live in suburbs and they don't eat anything that doesn't come in a plastic bag, somehow they go to these places and instantly connect with what feels oddly more foreign than the strange built environment that we've created for ourselves.
That's exactly right. I mean, almost everybody that we talk to, the historical figures that we excavated, the people that we spoke to that helped us to understand these stories and ourselves had exactly this experience that paradoxically you're made to feel your insignificance in the face of great nature. But that actually enlarges you. John Muir, the great naturalist, said in order to go in to know oneself, you had to go out. It was in nature that you were going back to some place that might afford you that ability to sort of wake up and see you, I, in relationship to the grander scheme of things. And that's what happens. And people would go in and say, I felt like I was coming home. I mean, there's 10 people in the film. If there's one, says, I felt like I was going home. That suddenly you're there in nature. All the stuff is turned out. It'll all be there. You know, you'll still, the Twitter, the video games, the Facebook, the TV, the radio, the car, all of those things will wait for you. But the possibility of actually having a real life with real experiences, something we don't have in our built environment and in this virtual world that we spend so much of our time with, is an unbelievable benefit. It is a huge curative.
There's a real synthesis here, at least with the show. Tomorrow we're doing an hour on Thoreau. And it's the idea is that Henry David Thoreau has been misunderstood and that his point was not that we should isolate ourselves within nature, but in fact we should incorporate nature into our everyday lives.
And that's exactly right. Yeah. And you know, you can see the continuum of this in the national parks. And Thoreau is a huge, important person, although he's not directly. When you say all men are created equal and you establish a democracy, we're also establishing a place that could worship God. People could worship God as they felt. And that was different than how it had been elsewhere. And the combined political and religious spiritual freedom would lead to Ralph Waldo Emerson and transcendentalism, which said we've inherited this beautiful Garden of Eden, this continent of ours. It's possible to find God more easily in a cathedral made in nature, the capital N, than in anything made by man, the hands of man, read Europe. And so Thoreau, being his most loyal disciple, extends it further. Emerson was content with a kind of intellectual exploration of that idea. Thoreau said, no, let's go out there. And so his disciple is someone like John Muir, this Scottish-born immigrant who comes and finds in the United States the alternative to this harsh Calvinist upbringing of his father who beat him until he memorized all of the New Testament, who beat him until he had memorized most of the Old Testament. And he came to Yosemite and said, I don't need that. I can embrace a God, a tolerant, a positive God in this American Eden. And that's where the parks are born.
Ken Burns is my guest. His latest project is called The National Parks, America's Best Idea. That airs in the fall on PBS stations, but he will also be speaking tonight at the Meyerson Symphony Center as part of the Brinker International Forum. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join our conversation, give us a call now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Filmmaker Ken Burns is my guest this hour. His new series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, will air in the fall of this year on PBS stations, including KERA 13. You can get a ticket to see him tonight at the Meyerson Symphony Center by going to dallasperformingarts.org. There are still some tickets available. You can find a link to that on the Think page of KERA.org. And if you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. I'm sure people who think about this imagine, how nice for Ken Burns. He got to be on vacation for years in the national parks. I wonder if you could talk about the kind of planning that it requires to do that, plus the challenges of outdoor cinematography.
Well, you got me. I give up. I've got the best job in the country. The interesting thing is that I'm never doing one thing at once. I have a co-producer and writer, Dayton Duncan. He's been working on this solidly for the 10 years, but I've been doing other things as well. One of those things was the history of the Second World War, which we released 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, called The War. And that had delved down deep, deep, deep into the archives with footage that had not been released before, with stories from veterans at the end of their lives willing to talk about the most difficult aspects of combat, stuff they'd never even spoken about to their families. So you can imagine what working in the editing room is like. You'd be dreaming at night that you're editing the Battle of Peleliu, this horrible, unnecessary battle that cost thousands of lives in the Pacific. And then all of a sudden the dream turned into being there, and you'd come in kind of baggy-eyed and, shell-shocked. The next morning to the editing room, the editor looks as bad as you, and I'd say, "Where were you?" And he'd said, "The bulge, you know." And to be able, after 3 or 4 weeks of giving the editors enough to go on for a while, to then go out to Yosemite was not just – it would have been fantastic if that was all we were doing. But to have it repair what I was watching – the Second World War is the greatest cataclysm in human history. 60 million people had to die before it was over, and we were carrying that. And the parks permitted us to sort of shed that burden a little bit. But having said that, we'd get up at 3 a.m. and you'd lug heavy equipment, 2 or 3 miles up a hill, 70 degrees below zero, 120 degrees above. It was rough and it was tough and it was exhilarating, watching a glacier calve, as they call it, shedding some of the glacier to come across bear and amazing other wildlife in various places that you didn't expect. Just seeing these works. I mean, one of the great things about the Park Service is a lot of the shots that we took that are the most spectacular shots in the film, you can take from a pullout along the highway because the National Park Service designed the road so that you could see it the way John Muir saw it, that you could see it the way Ansel Adams took his famous shot of Yosemite Valley. You can actually take that same shot. And that's a wonderful testament, again, to the National. If you separate the military out of it, you look at those park rangers, the symbol of it, and they are more adored than any other federal employees that we have. And you can learn as much science and as much history from them as your brain can stand, and they'll give it to you at any time of day and night. So for us, it was certainly an athletic event and difficult and great difficulty shooting outside always in this stuff and the patience required. But in the end, my goodness, the reward, looking at each other, just saying or pinching yourself, I'm being paid for this. I mean, it's PBS salaries, but
I hear you.
It's not nothing.
There's value to loving your work, I think, regardless of the compensation. Let's talk just for a minute about that glacier calving, because that is in the reel that I saw. And I just wondered about how fortunate are you to be there on that day? Does this thing happen every day?
Probably. Yeah, this is the Eyalik Glacier, which is part of Kenai Fjords in Alaska near the town of Seward, named after the Secretary of State who had the foresight to buy Alaska from the Russians.
Such a folly after all.
Definitely not a folly at all. It's one of the most spectacular places on Earth. And this was – we were on a Park Service boat, and we then got out into a Zodiac, a little, rubberized motorboat, and we're just sort of going around the glaciers. And it's interesting, when they calve, there's a huge wave action that happens, and the seals that are lying on the broken pieces of ice sort of just bob up and down, but you know, it's coming towards your camera, and all of a sudden you shut off and then you grab the equipment to hold it steady. But a lot of it is patience. You hear about shooting ratios in films like this. Oh, we're 50 to 1 or 150 to 1. We don't really know. But a lot of times you're pointing your camera and hoping that something happens, or that moose that just disappeared behind the rise will come out over there. And yes, there he is magnificently, or the wonderful elk with a gigantic rack of antlers. And I mean, these are just priceless moments. And we, in many cases, I had an opportunity, as did Dayton Duncan, to bring his kids. I brought mine along. So you really felt like you were giving them moments that they wouldn't forget either. And part of the parks is the intimate transmission that we forget about. Yes, they're spectacular. Yes, they're important to science. Yes, they're important to history or nature or whatever that. But quite often, when we see them, we're replicating this intensely personal drama. My grandfather took my father, who took me, and I've taken my daughters. And when you participate in that, it provides not only, you know, not only you get these spiritual experiences, you just get, this is where you are with your mom and your dad. So when you're looking at the Grand Canyon, it matters very much that you're looking at exposed rock, pre-Cambrian Vishnu schist that is 1.7 billion years old. But it also matters just as much whose hand you're holding. You know, we found that in baseball. Every basketball or football story begins with the action. Oh, Michael Jordan hit the three-pointer at the buzzer and we won. Or Joe Montana threw the touchdown pass to Jerry Rice and we won. A baseball story begins, my mom or my dad took me, and then Willie Mays did this catch or somebody hit this home run. And that's very much like the national parks. It really matters who you see it with, and that forges connections to people. And right now, we're at this great existential moment in the history of the United States where the attendance of the national parks, all the units, just not just the parks but all the other things, it was about to approach 300 million a year, and it sort of leveled off and has gone down a little bit in some of the parks. And that's because it's just a very simple question. You can't round the kids up and get them into the minivan. Do they have Wi-Fi there? Do they have a TV? What can I get the receipt? And it may seem small, but that's literally what's happened. And existentialism, just to reduce it to its small, is sort of a tension between being and doing. And there's nothing of either in a virtual world. To have real experiences as a human being is to place yourself in front of choices that will ultimately determine how you're measured, how your life is measured. And what's so great about the national parks is that they offer these amazing places where those experiences do happen. And as I said before, all of that other stuff will wait for you. It'll still be there. You'll still be able to go back, and nothing will be missed. But now you might be able to talk about real experiences. My daughter was proposed to by her future husband, and then we were filming in the Grand Canyon, and she and I climbed out of the Grand Canyon, one of the most exhilarating and difficult experiences together. And I realized, as a daddy, this was one of the last things I was going to do as a daddy for this gal. And it is still one of the most moving things, not just for me, but for her. And you know that when she has kids, she will take her kids to the Grand Canyon and they will hike out. And then hopefully that will go on. And that's an incredibly moving thing. And it snuck up on us, not just me, but everyone involved in the film, in a way that brought the people that we interviewed to tears, that I think at times when the viewers watch sections of the film, bring them to tears, that you hadn't expected, that there could be so much emotion, intimate and big American kind of emotion, involved in something as simple as land that somebody just thought we should save and not put a mine in.
Ken Burns is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. What a pleasure. Mr. Burns, much of what you've done in your career is to confront our mythologies, our American mythologies, with the facts of history. And whether we're talking about the myth, you know, the myths of the American West or the Civil War and Lincoln or various others over the years. And given the social and economic situation we're in right now as an American historian, do we even need our myths anymore? What purpose do they function anymore? Thank you very much.
What a wonderful question that is. Yes, they do, because human beings create these myths to sort of give themselves a different kind of patina to the others. I mean, if I told you that I was 55, you might say, well, you're a young-looking 55. But if I told you I was 155, you'd say, now he's really spoken volumes. That when we tell when we make up these stories about ourselves. In baseball, the great one is that no matter how many times you can disprove that Abner Doubleday in Cooperstown, New York, had nothing to do with the founding of baseball, the Hall of Fame is still in Cooperstown, New York, and people still perpetuate this myth. And that's interesting, that a game born in crowded cities, it was the outlet for people who were increasingly being squeezed by a vertical urban city, should invent a creation myth that has to do with pastoral small-town America that tells you a little bit more about ourselves than if we just said, oh, yeah, it was born in Hoboken, New Jersey, because that was the place of green land. They could take the ferry across from Manhattan, which had no green spaces to speak of, to play this new game called base. We need that. We still need to be studying that, and particularly in hard times. I mean, just think about the way in which the Depression has entered our history, both in fact and reality and in myth, that helps us get through. Remember, I went through the Depression. You should be able to, you know, clean your plate, you know, mow the grass. I did it as a, you know. All of that stuff becomes part of what we hand down. It's very important to have all of those things intact.
You think we're prematurely invoking the Depression and trying to make sense of what's going on right now?
Yes and no. Of course, there are many eerie similarities. I'm now about to begin editing a film on the history of Prohibition. I just, in the course of making this film on the national parks, we passed through the Depression. I've been through the Depression in several films that I've worked on, and it is incredibly similar what was going on before the bust. So one, of course, prays it's not the case that a quarter of our workforce is out of work. We are, in some zoos, animals in some cities, animals in the zoo were shot and the meat distributed to the poor. We're not at that stage. That was what the Depression was like, coupled with the environmental disaster of the Dust Bowl. I mean, it's not like that. But I think we invoke it because we begin to see patterns of human frailty. We begin to see the way in which greed sometimes overtakes us, the way in which we are confident that good times can always last, in which this whole human enterprise we're involved in, which is to convince us that the end, nobody gets out of this alive. No one wants to know that. But none of us get out of this alive. And so we invent so many things to distract us from it. And something like this brings us up short and gives us a dose of reality and reminds us to begin to re-ask what are the most important things. And what we often discover is that they're not things, but experiences, relationships, places that we share in common, ideals that allow us to cohere. And those are the things I'm interested in.
We should say that Prohibition will be your first film in decades, not supported by a large pile of GM money.
That's right. I just want to say that General Motors, who are teetering right now, had since 1987 supported our films. And in 1999, we made a 10-year arrangement with them, at the end of which, this year, we knew it would be over. So it's nothing – their lack of sponsorship has nothing to do with the current crisis, though I'm sure had we gone on further, that it might have precipitated the ending of the relationship. And we found other supporters. But as you know, in public television, public radio, it's getting harder and harder out there. And we're always out with cup in hand looking for those strangers who are willing to help reach 40 million people with stories of our history, which I think will in the end be a good thing. To have a shared past is to actually be armed with all of the information you need to deal with the present and then to have a future.
Working on the war, one of the things that you were criticized for and that ultimately resulted in some changes to the finished film was the fact that there were not initially Hispanic characters portrayed.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that at first you said it can't be changed. It's already done and it's the way it's going to be. And then you changed your mind. Can you talk about the process that you went through to say, yes, it can be changed and, in fact, it would be improved by making these additions?
Well, first of all, people have to understand the context. We threw four darts at the United States and pick four towns: Waterbury, Connecticut, Mobile, Alabama, tiny Laverne, Minnesota, and Sacramento, California. We went to those cities. We interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, not on film, finding just turned out to be 43 people that we could actually talk to, seven of whom would talk about combat. We were not interested in ethnicity. We were interested in combat experience and a variety of combat experience. So we didn't have any German Americans. We didn't have any Irish Americans, much greater immigrant group than Hispanic Americans, who at that point were 2% of the population according to the 1940 census. The Hispanics that we talked to in that larger pool of interviews said, we don't want to talk. It was too painful to remember. The real heroes are our buddies that we left. And we found that across all ethnic groups. So we weren't actually after ethnicity. It would be like, you know, painting a still life of a handful of fruit in the bowl and you didn't have every fruit there. You would never go to Cezanne and say, hey, how come you don't have an apple? We only have oranges and peaches and bananas. What are you against apples? And you go, well, that was in our fruit bowl. And so that was sort of my initial response. But then I realized I've been telling stories in American history about stories that haven't been told, including significant Hispanic narratives in many of the films that I had done before and including one I was working on, the National Park. So I thought instead of sort of digging in the way we always do in this dialectically preoccupied society, why not just take a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King way? And I said, sure. So we found two guys that weren't from our four towns. And we filmed them, and we didn't put them in the film. We put them at the end of several of the episodes to just sort of say, you know, there's even more stories. And meanwhile, we'd already encouraged for the last 2 years all the local stations to produce their own stuff, and they were already doing that, and some of them focusing on ethnic groups the way we were not. I mean, we did end up with a couple of Japanese Americans, and they told us their story, and part of their story was being interned, and that was dramatic. And some African Americans came forward and spoke, and they were in segregated regiments. But we weren't. We were after combat experience. So we knew that we had been misunderstood, but we knew this was not an argument you won. It was an argument that you transcended with generosity. And so we made our film better in the extent that we got to meet Bill Lansford and Pete Arias, who told us blood-curdling stories of action on the Pacific. And I'm not even sure people were prepared for what kind of story we were trying to tell. And so it seemed to be a win-win situation for all of us. And, of course, it was the most watched PBS series in 15 years.
Ken Burns is my guest. His newest project will air in fall of 2009. It's called The National Parks, America's Best Idea. You can see him tonight at the Meyerson Symphony Center. That is an appearance sponsored by the Brinker International Forum. You can find information about it at dallasperformingarts.org or on the Think page of KERA.org. We'll return to your calls in a moment. You can also email us to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Ken Burns. You'll be able to see The National Parks, America's Best Idea, coming this fall on KERA Channel 13. And you can see Ken speak tonight at the Meyerson Symphony Center, sponsored by the Brinker International Forum. There are still tickets available. Go to the Think page to find out information about that. Let's go next to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hello, Maggie.
Hello. I spent many years as a seasonal park ranger before kids and things like that came along, and I had to settle down. And I loved it. It was wonderful. But one of the things that I learned early on was to go to very small parks and monuments to work, because in the large parks, the visitors love you and the park to death. And I don't think expectations are reasonable. People, you mentioned earlier, the kids, you know, want Wi-Fi and games and all that. Well, they still get that, actually. The concessions provide it. And the clamoring for things from home, I think, dilute the experience of the park. And I'm just wondering if you have looked at that.
Thanks for your call.
It's a very great question. And in fact, we have a chapter within our last episode, the sixth episode, called Love to Death. I mean, one of the great tensions of a democracy and of the national parks is they're there for the benefit and enjoyment of the people. But they're also, by the act that created the National Park Service, supposed to be left unimpaired for future generations. So You want lots of people to come. You want lots of constituents loving the park so that people will keep funding them and doing the necessary upkeep. But you also, there's not a family that's taken a trip to the national parks that doesn't know what it's like to sit in a traffic jam in Yellowstone or Yosemite. The important thing to remember, and I do know a lot of people who consciously go to the smaller places and the others, is that you can park at any of these places and perhaps wait for a parking place. And then within about 5 minutes, you can get to a place where there are no other human beings. And that involves walking, and some people aren't able to do that, and that's terrible. And hopefully the way the parks have been designed in the last 50 years with an eye towards the individual automobile and family, the windshield experience would be okay. But it is possible to escape that kind of loving it to death. But this is a problem I want to have. When my Civil War film came out, about a year later, I was walking across the lawn towards the visitor center at Gettysburg with the superintendent. And he bent down, he picked up a popsicle wrapper that was on the grass, and he held it up, and with a twinkle in his eye, he said, "It's all your fault." His attendance had gone up 200-300% and had not diminished at all since the Civil War series was broadcast. That's the kind of problem you want to have. You can always pick up the tin cans, is what the first director of the National Park Service, Stephen Mather, said. You can always pick up the tin cans. But if nobody's coming to a park, you've suddenly isolated them. They don't have natural constituents who can argue when somebody says, "Oh, let's put a dam, let's mine this, let's add too many snowmobiles, let's put a power plant next to the thing." So you've got to have people coming, and that in itself creates that tension between wearing out the scenery, one Park Service director said, or loving these places to death. But those are good problems for a democracy to have. That's what we've been struggling in a larger sense with. When Thomas Jefferson said all men are created equal and set this thing off, he meant all white men of property free of debt. Well, that doesn't stand for that anymore. We've been able to enlarge that. In fact, he owned other human beings as he wrote that thing. So we've changed. And I think the parks have had to expand. We were originally just spectacular natural scenery. Then they were about habitats and ecosystems, and then their historical sites. We even have places of shame. A great country can acknowledge things that it didn't do well. Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, was one of the great focal points of the crisis of desegregation, is a national park site in addition to being a working high school. We have places where there were massacres of Native Americans at Sand Creek and Washita, Manzanar, where Japanese Americans were interned during the Second World War, is part of the National Park Service. So is Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where the heroic actions of United Flight 93 took place. So is, you know, all Oklahoma City, the greatest act of domestic terrorism. I mean, we are a country so expansive enough that we can embrace things that have gone wrong or things that we have done wrong into a system that is not just pretty waterfalls and exploding geysers.
You know, when you mentioned the idea of, you know, trash being thrown around and people sort of overusing the parks, one thing that really took me by surprise was how much ownership I felt when I saw shots of the parks that I have visited, places I've been to in all but one case, only one time in my life. And it was as if you showed the street that I grew up on.
Exactly. And that's what I was saying earlier about feeling like you're going home. And in fact, it's extended even further. I met a woman who's a novelist, Nevada Barr, that we interview for the film. She's a former park ranger, and she hasn't been to any of the Alaska parks, but she said she sleeps better at night knowing they're there. So I think also that we've preserved it, that it's there. You know, people always talk about where does the value of the United States come from? It comes from the land. And these are the places that are preserved and pristine and give you a view into what your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents could have seen.
Let's go next to Barry in Dallas. Hi, Barry.
Hi. This is a real treat to be able to have Ken Burns on the show. I'm a big fan of his work and actually a big fan of Sync as well. My question has to do with kind of the political philosophies of Lincoln and Roosevelt, who set aside so many, such a tremendous amount of land for posterity, and how Ken Burns thinks that meshes in with their political philosophies, even their political party, and then also further how that would compare today with that same political philosophy.
Well,
I'm just real curious about that.
Barry, that's a great question and an ongoing one, and it's so hard to talk with any real authority or perspective about the current things. We're obviously in a place where we are so politicized, that everything sort of gets taken hostage by that politicization. Abraham Lincoln gave the parks the first tentative expression. He also, in the middle of the Civil War, helped start the Transcontinental Railroad and the land and the Homestead Act and all these wonderful things that really changed the face of the United States. Theodore Roosevelt picked up that mantle as a president. As I was saying, most of the story of the national parks is bottom-up stories of ordinary people. But Theodore Roosevelt's cousin, Franklin Roosevelt, is no less important. This has been a bipartisan story. That's the best news about the national parks. They are adored by Republicans and Democrats and independents. And I think that very often ideology kind of gets in the way, and sometimes you'll find a less activist president. But more often than not, this is a wonderfully bipartisan, therefore American story. It's not to say that these tensions won't always be with us. They're always with us. They're there in the larger democracy as we argue about other aspects. They're there in the national parks when we talk about the tensions between local and federal, when we talk about all of the different sort of dichotomies that creep up when you set aside land that other people may want to exploit. But that's great. That's what makes human drama. That's what makes the human story. And because it's a democratic experience, we actually have the possibility that a majority can win and say, we will create this. I was in the White House yesterday as the president set aside 2 million more acres of land, and standing behind him was the entire leadership of the House and the Senate and on both sides of the aisle. And there you were looking at a glorious, wonderful thing that didn't get in the news this morning because other things were going on. But it was a hugely positive and very impressive moment and represented the culmination of work of lots of different groups and lots of different people across the aisles.
Let's go next to Mark in Addison. Hello, Mark.
Hi. How are y'all doing?
Great. Thank you.
Good. I wish I was as good at my job as Ken Burns is at his.
I think we should. We all share that.
Do a wonderful job. I just wanted to say I visited the Grand Canyon for the first time last year on a couple-week-long tour of the Southwest, and it's just incredible out there. What I'm getting to is reinforced just by this past weekend down at Longhorn Cavern down by Burnett, Texas. And even there, it's currently a state park, but it started out as a national park, and they had a lot of work done by the CCC during the Depression. And so I just wanted to, highlight the amount of payoff that we got as a nation from Franklin Roosevelt's CCC programs through the national parks. And whether or not you think it's about time we actually, did something like that again to get more people to work and get people to work in the parks that will pay dividends on the work they do for generations to come. I went to Longhorn Caverns. I was using the trails that were built by the CCC in the 30s. And, how much more do you think needs to be put into this effort?
Well, a huge part of President Obama's stimulus goes into the Interior Department and specifically into the National Park. So I think you'll be seeing a kind of modern-day version of a CCC happening there. But you're absolutely right, and our film details, I think, with loving and sometimes moving detail, the story of the CCC, which brought not only jobs and money into the community, but dignity to those workers, and then also the sense of permanence. It helped Americans cohere, and we still today walk on those trails and picnic in those rest areas that were built during this time. Strangely enough, paradoxically enough, the national parks were thriving during the Depression. They not only got the stimulus money, and they were shovel ready, to use the today's terms, ready to go at the beginning, and a pet project of Franklin Roosevelt's, but they continue, as the gentleman said, paying dividends, that we still feel that sense of cohesion that comes from that joint ownership of the national parks. These are ours. And whether it's hiking down the Bright Angel Trail and back up, as one of our commentators in the film said, 7 miles down and 107 miles back up, or whether it's having one of these local experiences or even in the very remote sites that may just be about the ancient Puebloans and seeing the cliff dwellings or something of Mesa Verde or Chaco Canyon. You could basically stop right now, take a month, and just tour the Western Parks with your family, starting at Glacier Park and the Canadian border and getting down to Big Bend, and you'd still miss half of them, and you'd have experiences of a lifetime. And we've come across people in history and today who spend nothing but their whole lives or summers doing that and visiting the national parks and getting their passports as they give you stamped with a different stamp from a national park and collecting parks as people have been doing since the teens.
This question from Lorinda takes us a little off topic, but I can't think of anybody better qualified to answer it. She says, my next door neighbor is 89. I'd love to learn what he experienced and learned during the Depression, but he seems a little self-deprecating about his own wisdom and he's quiet. Any suggestions on how I could approach him to learn from his experiences?
It's very interesting. We found that, you know, sort of amplified at our World War II things. And most of the time these veterans had told their family sort of funny stories that were the kind of moat around their real experiences. And when our series came out, I've gotten so many letters from families saying, now Dad is talking, now Grandpa's talking. He always had told a funny joke about the Battle of the Bulge. Now he broke down and told us about losing his best friend, a guy whose name we'd never heard. And for 60 years, they'd labored under this humorous story of, you know, taking over a Belgian farmhouse and it had a wine cellar and they all got drunk. Ha, ha, ha. But now there was something more and more complicated and sad and more tragic, but they felt they'd been given a gift. Quite often it's a reminder that you get to the end of your life, you're losing friends, you want to go back. I think that patient and tolerant and ultimately forgiving if they don't want to talk approach is the best way. That's the only way I know it, is just to sit down, continue to talk and ask questions. And I'm sure it's about self-deprecation. I've found people from that generation unbelievably unwilling to take credit for something they did, say, in the Second World War, which was save the world. They're just so singularly uninterested in taking credit for it, where all the rest of us sort of were happy to own just about anything that's taken place on our watch, as long as it's good. So I think just patience, and that's how I've done it as an interviewer. And I've been interviewing people for 39 years, and I still feel like I'm an amateur.
It is amazing, though, that there are questions that we can ask people as journalists or as interviewers that are much harder to ask our own families.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we found in the Second World War that it was often the grandchildren. The wife hadn't heard the story yet. The sons and the daughters hadn't heard the story. But there was something that a grandchild could ask, or maybe it was just the passage of time, or maybe the sense of immortality that was implicit in the continuing life of this grandchild that made him or her say, okay, this is what happened. I was on this island. I had a friend, and it was horrible. And suddenly the grandkids were given the privileges. You know, we were able to find three CCC veterans, and two are from Texas. One is a man named Juan Lujan. The other is Claude Tyler. One's from Blossom, Texas. The other's from Redford near the Rio Grande and the Big Bend. And their stories are so moving. And you realized how disrupted our lives were and how much pride has sort of formed a shell over it. And now, just at the end of their lives, they're willing to share with us what it was like, the danger that one felt, that, as Juan Lujan said, I found that the money that was supporting us was from the Paupers Fund. And he breaks down in his 80s now, still at what he thinks was the shame, but he found dignity in the parks and CCC.
The new film by Ken Burns will debut in the fall. It's called The National Parks, America's Best Idea. He will be at the Meyerson tonight at 8. There are still tickets available. Ken, such a pleasure. Thank you so
much.
My
pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.